Let me introduce myself. I'm less important than the speaker. But my name is Presmit Cox. I've been at the LSE since 2002, Department of International Relations, and now Director of LSE Ideas, which is the LSE's foreign policy think tank. We don't really care about league tables unless we come first or second or third. We came second in those league tables in the world, so I was very pleased with that. But anyway, very nice to have you here this evening. Thank you, thank you. Yeah, good. A bit more. Well, welcome to the LSE Festival. This is one of the great LSE new institutions, which is establishing itself. And it does many, many things. It kind of takes the message or messages outside the LSE. It talks to a larger public than just our students or academics, although they are allowed in. And so it's one of the things that I think the LSE does. It's public engagement, I think, in the very best sense of the word. Too many institutions of higher education are ivory towers, and we try not to be one. So welcome to this festival. As you can see, if you look at the festival program, there's lots and lots of things going on. Try and get along to most of them. This is my third event in the LSE Festival for this week. We're actually only on Tuesday night. Yesterday I did John Maynard Keynes and the Versailles Peace Treaty. This afternoon I did Whatever Happened to the Revolution of the LSE in the 1960s. And now this evening I'm talking to Cherry and have the honour and privilege to chair my very good friend and ally and mates, if I can use that old-fashioned phrase, Danny Kwa. I got to know Danny here back in the LSE many years ago. We worked together. He was an economist. And I was in IR. He taught me a little bit of economics. I taught him a lot of IR. And so it's been a great relationship with Danny. Danny and I also had great fun together in Beijing. We helped run and teach on the LSE Peking University Summer School for many years. I had room number 2, and I think you had room number 1, or was it the other way around? But anyway, we taught at that wonderful institution for many years together. On that summer school, another great LSE international initiative. Danny, I think, needs very little introduction to this group of people here. Danny was at the school for many, many years. He was a great public intellectual. He engaged in the real world issues. And one of the real world issues that Danny and I constantly had discussions about, and I think we didn't always agree, was on the whole question of where is power in the world, where is it, and is it moving rapidly or slowly towards Asia, and indeed, obviously, towards China, and what's going to happen to the United States. Now, before Donald Trump was elected, I was a bit more confident. I have to say, since Donald occupied the White House, quite literally, you know, I may even be getting a bit weak on this issue, Danny, but I always used to argue that never underestimate the Americans, never underestimate American power. And Danny was saying, watch out. And as you know, there's been an ongoing debate in the United States and elsewhere, in China and Asia and across the world, about the future of the American empire, if you prefer that term, or the American century. I even lined up a few quotes here, Dan, but titles. Andrew Bacevich, recent book, Twilight of the American Century. Victor Bulmer Thomas, an old friend from Chatham House, Empire in Retreat. Edward Luce from the Financial Times, Dan, you remember? Time to Start Thinking, America and the Spectre of American Decline. And on the other side of the debate, of course, Martin Jakes, many years ago, wrote a book, When China Rules the World. Gideon Rackman from the FT, friend of the LSE and LSE Ideas, wrote a book called Easternization. And we've got Parag Khanna coming here next week to tell us why the future is Asian. So you can see there's a big debate there to be had. I cannot think of anybody better to have that debate with than a good old friend of LSE's, Professor Danny Kwa. Now, Danny, you're on.
Thank you.
Give him a big hand.
Thank you very much, Danny. Thank you, Mick, for the very generous and kind introduction. Thank you all for sharing this evening with us in this conversation. When I was at LSE, together with Mick Cox, George Gaskell, and a number of others in the audience and elsewhere, we tried to fight the good fight, the interdisciplinary fight. Because we thought that, you know, any one social science by itself, in its silo, there was only limited progress that it would make understanding the world. This was not always a very popular position. There are many who feel that the disciplinary cycles are exactly the right things to do. But this evening, I want to pretend that I am again an economist. I am an economist by training, and I'm obviously wandering into talking about waters that are far deeper than many than my own training as an economist really allows me to go. Issue of world order. World order is about the great nations of the world. It's about how we run the global affairs in the world. It's about how systems of hegemony, multipolarity, the great competition between the United States and China, how all the other nations line up in the world. And that's not something that economists wander into. In fact, that is a domain for real, genuine international relations scholars who object to economists wandering casually into that area. You know, the economists have talked at LSE. There is a tradition, it turns out, of economists engaging with the international relations scholarship. But that goes back many decades. There was a time when Susan Strange was in the IR department, and she used to poke fun at the economists for their understanding of international relations. Economists at that time, to the extent they talked about international issues, they talked about perhaps international trade, perhaps international finance, and that came under the rubric of international political economy. So what I'm going to do this evening is to again bring back that time of engagement between the economists and international relations scholars, perhaps on once again on slightly antagonistic grounds, but I hope friendlier than just one of us poking fun at the other. So I'm back to talking about economics. But IR scholars find it quite objectionable that international relations, that international relations, which is their field, global order, the international system, something that they've studied for decades, could be casually discussed by those whose skills come from another domain. And I am fully sympathetic with them. World order, however, is something that no one can avoid at this point. Whether it's popular discussion about the trade war between the United States and China, great power competition, 5G, the race for 5G technological supremacy, it seems like there's nothing you can turn, nowhere you can turn, that you don't run into these issues of world order. In fact, for far longer, writers other than international relations and economic specialists have been talking about world order. Discussion has come primarily from the intellectual left, where they've said it's been long enough that the established powers, the United States, the West, have run the world. It is time for the rest. It is the rise of the rest. And there's a certain moral justice, you know, there's social justice warriors, SJWs, there's a certain moral justice warrior tone to that discussion. The only thing I've got working in my favor is that if there's something that irritates international relations scholars more than economists talking about world order, it is moral justice warriors talking about world order. The argument is it is time for the third world, the emerging South. It is time for them now to run the world. IR scholarship is about taking a cold, hard-hearted, hard-nosed look at how the world operates, not about moral justice warrior type of consideration. So what I'm going to do this evening, actually, is to argue the moral justice warrior position, but not from the perspective that says it is now time for the rest to run the world. I want to do it from the perspective of how an economist would make that argument, using the tools of the marketplace, using tools of supply and demand. In other words, I want to be, if you use the jargon, more realist than the realists. I want to take more seriously the idea that nations pursue their own self-interest. America, China, whoever, should be about pursuing their own self-interest. But whereas the realists end up in a position that then says when nations pursue their own self-interest, maximize the probability for their own survival, they run into international conflict, the Thucydides trap will lead to war between America and China. I want to use the same assumptions, the same realist assumptions, but come up with something perhaps a little bit more optimistic. come up with something that says that, no, that's not the direction that we're going to go. Now, when I say everyone talks about world order these days, I mean that literally. Okay. It's much more effective when the slide moves when I click. But,
Welcome back to the LSE, Danny. LSE technology.
May I? You've been
in first world Singapore.
Okay, so that rather than mouse. Now, the effect is ruined, of course, because it didn't operate.
Oh, what's this, Danny? What are you doing?
Okay, so when I said everybody talks about world order, popular culture talks about world order. The blockbuster movie of 2018 in the power action man Tom Cruise genre was this, Mission Impossible, Fallout. And it was about what else but how the world order needs dismantling and we have the tools to dismantle it. Huh. This was the conversation between the protagonists on the other side. It's not just the intellectual left, the moral justice warrior community, that feels that world order needs dismantling. It's about a group of people who feel that they want to run the world better, the Anakin Skywalkers of the world. And they want to run the world better, and they were going to do this. And of course, Tom Cruise, Action Man's job was to save the world from these maniacs. And in fact, this is an abiding theme in all secret agent movies, whether it's James Bond or whoever else. It's about world order. It's about a group of people who are set against world order and want to dismantle it. Both right and left are in the game of dismantling world order. What about those people who actually study it seriously? International relations scholarship. How do they view world order? Well, a lot of world order, I want to argue, has emerged from the IR scholarship. Not all, but a lot. Takes world order, takes this thing that, you know, that the enemy to Tom Cruise, the people on the other side, wanted to dismantle as being about great power competition. So what do I mean? It's about how when there is a change in the international system, ships, missiles, navy get marshaled out into the oceans of the world. It's about jet airplanes, battleships, aircraft carriers. It's about moving pieces around on the grand chessboard of international politics. It's about the great powers. World order is about geostrategic rivalry and about great power competition. And you see this over and over. I mean, I had already referred to the realists. Offensive realists like John Mearsheimer at the University of Chicago. He, together with Graham Allison, self-identify as, you know, those who take a cold, hard-nosed look at international politics. And for them, they have no time for this idea that something's going on in the world that might change global order, whether it's from a moral justice warrior-type reasoning. Fareed Zakaria writing about the rise of the rest. My colleague Kishore Mahbubani talk about the Asian century, how it is time for Asia to take leadership in the world. They have no time for any of these things. For them, it is great powers that shape the international system, that shape world order. The great powers have a single objective, self-preservation. They want to maximize the probability of survival. Every great power wants to do that, whether it's America or China, and that leads them to the tragedy of competition. And it's that tragedy of competition that is inevitable. It comes from almost axiomatic economic reasoning. You write down assumptions that say nations want to maximize their self-probability of survival. That leads inevitably to conflict in the kind of historical narrative that Mearsheimer, Stephen Walt, Graham Allison, and other people discuss. So on one extreme, these people have no time for the moral justice warrior interpretation that one might want to place to world order. For them, it is inevitable that the world eventually go to war. As China continues to rise, America will feel threatened. China will want to expand its domain of control and influence. There's only a limited world that we operate in. These two great powers are going to clash. Graham Allison's wonderful work on the Thucydides trap shows how, as a statistical regularity, when an established great power, the hegemon, sees challenge, implicit or otherwise, by a rising power, conflict ensues. So this is one view of the world, and for them, world order is exactly the picture that I just showed you. Okay, of course, there are others who think about how world order looks, and at first, it might seem like they get away from great power competition. There's something, there's a way of thinking in international relations that's referred to as liberal internationalism. Often they're viewed as in opposition to the offensive realists, the realists, and they talk about how world order is about being an inclusive community, where there are specific nations that might be leaders in that community. They're not rulers. They are hegemons used in the original Greek sense of the word. They're benevolent leaders. They're not rulers who exercise power against the rest of the international community. And this arguably is the system that many of us think America has built over the last 70 years. It is a system that's structured by multilateralism. There's international rule of law. International rule of law is hugely important to the lesser nations in the world. The nation that I live in now, Singapore, it's a tiny nation, 720 square kilometers in area, 5 million people. It operates in the international scene because it has the confidence to navigate that landscape, knowing that there are rules, that there's international rule of law, not the arbitrary exercise of power. And nations like Singapore, and in fact, arguably the United Kingdom likes to think it punches above its weight. But the fact of the matter is, it's not a very large economy at this point. And there are many who think that it does what it does because it is America's great ally in the world. But there's a community of nations, and this liberal internationalism, it's an open, inclusive, transparent organization that even after the great leaders, the great hegemons have determined how it should look, it wants to, seeks to bring everyone into the system. And it operates the globalization that we've all benefited from. It operates the international. It operates an international system based on rule of law. There's a slightly unpleasant side to this that has to do with how those at the center, the unipolar center of the international rules-based system, also, for no reason that has to do with this, with how the rules-based order is structured, but also have the view that their system, the system of Western-style liberal democracy, is the right one for the world. That even as the American presidents who constructed this inclusive system wanted to bring in those who initially opposed them, there was always the idea that Western-style liberal democracy was the endpoint for which all nations would eventually converge. I mean, that endpoint idea came to stark, ugly reality when Frank Fukuyama wrote The End of History and argued that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was no longer any point thinking about alternative systems, multiple pathways to economic prosperity or political success because Western-style liberal democracy was the only political aspiration that all nations and geographies could subscribe to. When I say that's a slightly ugly side to that, of course, in the reality, America and other nations at the center of this international rules-based order have sometimes been a little bit more aggressive about trying to converge other nations towards that endpoint, trying to undertake regime change that would bring nations to this Western-style liberal democracy. But that's, I think, we want to separate then from the workings of the international rules-based order. This is a rules-based order that operates by hegemony because there needs to be a police officer, a security officer that maintains that international rule of law. And in its early form, it was something called hegemonic stability theory, the idea that at the center of the system, a single great power, a hegemon, that was a benevolent leader, would be the one that organized the system, consumer of last resort, stabilized the international financial system, provided the security architecture, saved the world from global epidemics. It did all the things that benevolent leaders did. Liberal internationalism, therefore, is at the other extreme from the kind of realism that I described just a second ago. But nonetheless, it is a system based on power. John Eikenberry, one of the great advocates of this liberal international system, described how American global power was what was the linchpin for how this international rules-based order worked. And it's a way of thinking that goes a long ways back, because Truman, when he was asked by a young Henry Kissinger, what is it that will make you proudest of your presidency? Truman said, the fact that we, America, defeated the rest of the world in every single dimension, in war, in technology, in economics, in finance. But nonetheless, our goal was not to dominate the world. Our goal was to bring everyone else back into the fold. So this is liberal international system is indeed inclusive and transparent, provided that eventually you subscribe to these ideals. Not necessary, but it would be great if you did. But it was built on, nonetheless, power. It is always power that underlies discussion of world order in the range of scholarship, from offensive realism to an international, to a liberal internationalism. And the beginnings of this system, we now think of as, you know, the American century, came from journalists like Henry Luce, who convinced Americans that they needed to go out in the world. They needed to make the world their own. And by in doing so, they crafted the American century. And as you know, Mick has referred to, there are many observers, not least Americans themselves, who argue if the American century might not be coming to an end. That's not what I'm going to talk about tonight, although it's implicit in what I'm going to say. But world order, as articulated in these people, these writers that I've just run through, is founded on power. And even when Truman, Henry Luce, John Eikenberry and others talk about the system being inclusive, nonetheless, when it's interpreted by someone like, say, Joe Nye, it is embedded in a discussion of power. Mm-hmm. Being inclusive, getting others to come along with you, getting others to agree with you, is what Joe Nye calls soft power. And, you know, Nye's interpretation is that we don't want to think about world order is founded on just hard power, those military architectures that I showed you pictures of earlier, but it's also based on soft power. And America has been the supreme wielder of soft power. Nonetheless, it is all about power. World order is about geostrategic rivalry. It's about great power competition, and it's all about power, and it's about the great powers. In the words of Kenneth Waltz, another political science international realist, international relations theorist, a realist, he said, of course, talking about international politics, talking about world order, has to be about the great powers. Why would you even spend time on insignificant states like Malaysia or Costa Rica or Singapore, mm-hmm. when you want to talk about world order? It is ridiculous to try and construct a theory of international relations that steps outside the United States, the United Kingdom, perhaps China, the Soviet Union, because that, whether you are a realist or a liberal internationalist or a believer in soft power, that is how world order constructs itself. That's how it self-identifies. Mm-hmm. Kenneth Waltz goes further. He said, look, you know, really, what world order is about is kind of like oligopolistic competition. It's kind of like about, you know, the great large businesses in an industry battling each other for control of the market, control of the industry. Why would you ever want to step outside that domain? What I want to do, as an economist, is step outside that domain. Because when I read something like this, I say, you know what? A general equilibrium theorist, a microeconomist, a macro, any economist outside of the international industrial organization people will say that if you want to understand the workings of the system, the market, you've got to understand both the demand side as well as the supply side. And oligopolistic competition takes a particular view about the supply side, but IR discussion of world order is completely silent on the demand side. It's completely silent on why we have world order. It's only about what world order the great powers can construct. And perhaps it is right that we confine our discussion to that, because as Walt says, why concern yourself with anything that everybody else might say about the market or about the international system, about world order. Because you should just look at the IBMs and the Microsofts and the Googles of the world, because that's where the market is determined. Well, actually, markets don't work like that. Markets work because there's a demand side and a supply side. What I want to do is this. When I say I want to talk about a marketplace for world order, I want to think about a demand curve and a supply curve. I want to think about world order as being formed by the interaction between supply and demand. And this is about as hard-nosed as social science gets. There's nothing about how it is time for the rest of the world to take its place alongside the traditional great powers. There's nothing about that. It's about demand and supply. It's about markets, where there's world order on the horizontal axis that's determined by an interaction between the supply side and the totally ignored until now demand side. When traditional IR scholarship talks about great power competition, what they're talking about is how the supply side curve comes together, how it is formed, who the players are that go towards forming this upward sloping supply curve. And they leave completely silent the Malaysias and the Costa Ricas and all the other lesser nations that are the demand side of this marketplace. Now, of course, this is something that needs to be justified. So to be very clear now, to try and summarize what I've said, I want to think about world order, that quantity on the horizontal axis, as being some multidimensional object. It's a joint distribution of power and responsibility across all of the nations, across both demand and supply side in the international community. And it's about a shared understanding of the relations between those states. One of the significant points about such a definition is that world order is not about order. It's not about order in the same sense that order is the opposite of disorder. World order is just like a ranking. It's a particular outcome. There's need be nothing good or bad about it. Okay. The unfortunate thing is that in the English language, order, the word, is overloaded with meanings. The obsidian order is about a shadowy group of Kardashian, not Kim Kardashian, but fictional Kardashian civilization secret agents who in the wonderful Star Trek series Deep Space Nine, the obsidian order is the shadowy group behind, you know, arranging things. In Lara Croft Tomb Raider, the Illuminati are this secretive order that's running things behind the world. So there's a whole range of this. Order in the English language is overloaded with meaning, because many of us think world order means something good. It is orderly. World order does not, in this definition, mean that. It is simply the outcome of demand and supply in that picture that I just drew you. It's simply whatever international regime emerges. And my job, my work, my research, the research that's come out of all my conversations, many of my conversations with Mick on the shores of Lake Wei Min Hu in Beita University, yeah. Where Mick and I and Arnie Westad and others who came to this Peking University summer school that we ran with LSE, we debated endlessly. So what I want to tell you about now is how an economist would look at these international relations issues in a way that's as realist as I think the realist would want to get. I want to talk about marketplace for world order. Now, I know I don't have a huge amount of time, so if you'll allow me, perhaps just 10, 15 minutes or so to talk through this. Because I want to report to you how this alternative vision of world order looks. Conceptually, theoretically, analytically, empirically, what the history indicates. Does history indicate that the Malaysians and Costa Ricas of the world actually have a role in determining how the international system looks? Or is it really just the competition between great powers? Is it about geostrategic rivalry between the one or two, the G2 nations? There's the research that I'm talking about here unpack this analytically, empirically. I want to just give you a flavor of what that research looks like. Okay. I am far from the first to talk about the demand side. But for some reason, all these other people who talk about the demand side haven't taken it as far as I think they might. Bob Cohen, the great international relations theorist, who in some instances is as realist as they come. I would like to say he was a teacher of mine, both when I was an undergraduate and a postgraduate student, but unfortunately I never took a course from him because I was so, as my good friend Yun Fong, who's now a colleague of mine at Lee Kuan Yew School, is an international relations scholar. He and I were graduate students together, and he reminds me that when I was a graduate student, I had no time for international relations theory. I was interested only in economics, and if I couldn't put it in an equation, I just wasn't interested. But Bob Cohen was one of the great IR scholars, both at Princeton and at Harvard, where I was a student on this, and actually as long ago as 1982, he talked about how the theory of hegemonic stability was about the supply of international regimes. It was about how a single benevolent leader, the hegemon, the monopolist in that supply curve, provided an international system, but fluctuations in demand for international regimes were hardly ever taken into account in that reasoning. And Cohen then went on to write papers developing this idea. So there is a literature, even in international relations, that talk about supply and demand. Amitav Acharya, who's a great scholar on global governance, talks about how when we talk about global governance, we spend all our time talking about who governs, great power rivalry, geostrategic competition. But we never talk about why govern. What's the other side of this engagement, of this domain that we are governing for? Who's the demand side of global governance? So Amitav Acharya wrote this in the introduction to a wonderful volume, but nowhere else then in that volume does he return to this topic, as far as I can tell. And our old friend, David Held, who used to be a professor here as well, talked about in his latest work on gridlock, talks about how international cooperation has been focused on the supply side of the equation. But again, he does not do anything with the idea that that's the supply side of the equation. There ought to be a demand side to put into this. And that is what I'm bringing back in. I'm bringing demand back into this discussion. And you know, when I've spoken to international relations scholars, let me just very quickly spend 2 seconds on this. When I talk to international relations scholars, they look at this picture and they say, ha, there you go again. You're an economist oversimplifying things, because world order that you've put on the horizontal axis clearly cannot be described as just a straight line. It is not, world order is not linear. It's all made up of all these complications. But of course, those of you who are trained at LSE, who've taken Economics B, know that when you put world order on horizontal axis like this, it is simply shorthand for how there can be a far richer description of the commodity space. It can be multidimensional, and that multidimensional commodity space can accommodate many different sides to world order. So, but that's the stylized picture I want to take into. So is this completely crazy? After all, IR scholars have spent decades trying to think this through. How dare you come up with this suggestion that they've ignored something very important? Because as Kenneth Waltz said, you know, it's only the great powers that matter in international politics. There is an analogy. So if you bear with me, let me take 2 minutes to draw an analogy. And that analogy is with the market for taxi rides.
Yeah.
Now, of course, in London, you now no longer have Uber. You've got black taxis.
I don't got Uber.
But Uber's in... Oh, do you? Has it come back?
Okay. Never went away.
Never went away.
I'm going home tonight with Uber.
Okay, very good, very good.
I hope. It's half price.
I misread some of the discussion. But in Singapore and elsewhere in the world, there's a thriving competition in the market for taxi rides. Uber, Grab, TT Chuxing in China, Gojek in Indonesia, spreading across a lot of Asia now. And let's think about the analogy with great power competition there. Because there might be those who argue for providing taxi rides, it is, of course, the providers of taxi rides that determine the marketplace, because they're the ones with the hardware. As Kenneth Waltz might say, when you talk about great power politics, it's only the great powers that have the aircraft carriers and the missiles that can make things happen in the world. Well, similarly, in the market for taxi rides, it is only the taxi companies that have taxis. All the rest of us don't. But of course, there's this thing called technological innovation, where the largest taxi companies, largest car ride companies, actually today don't own taxis. They no longer have hardware. All of that is outsourced, is contracted out. The world's largest car ride companies, the world's largest real estate managers, no longer have the hardware to make the marketplace work. What they've recognized is that it's both demand and supply. So in Singapore, we've got a wealth of different kind of taxi ride services, none of which rely critically on the provider actually having a fleet of taxis to operate. So too, we should get away from the idea that great power competition, world rival, you know, world order, is about those who can provide hardware in terms of aircraft carriers and missiles. It ought to be about supply and demand. You know, there's all these questions there. What actually appears on the price and quantity axes? What about externalities and public goods? How do you fit that in the marketplace? But the wonderful thing about putting it in the marketplace is that it's no longer personal. I'm talking about interpreting the decline of the United States in world order, not from the perspective of how it is time for someone else to take their place. It is simply supply and demand. Okay. So how does that demand, how does that supply and demand work? Okay. So what I want to do now is spend just a few minutes talking about some of the research that underlies these themes that I'm developing. Can I identify shocks, disturbances on the supply side and demand side? And then can I use these shocks to estimate where world order is going? And the way my structure approaches these things is not just about great power rivalry, nations seeking to maximize their probability for survival. It's about supply and demand. So there is a first observation on the demand side acceptability of the traditional supply of world order. Opinions on the United States, documented by Pew and others, are on the decline. This was happening even before Donald Trump decided to single-handedly take on undermining the great institutions of the world. Opinions on the United States have been on the decline. The demand-side acceptability of the supply provided by America is on the decline. Let me skip global trade. Let me talk about shocks on the demand side. There are three large shocks on the demand side. Let me spend a little bit of time on these. The first is, what is the footprint of the traditional demand side world order players? Let's look at the emerging nations. In Kenneth Waltz's scope view of the world, these are players that he has never had any time for. They just do not figure in his thinking of international politics. What are these emerging nations doing? This is the graph that shows the evolution over the last three decades of the economic footprint of all of the emerging nations taken together, 180 of them so, as a ratio of the economic footprint of the traditional centers of global power, the G7. So this just says, take the combined GDP of all the emerging nations, 180 of them, and then take that as a ratio relative to the combined GDP of the G7, the seven richest societies, at the center of them, the United States. This ratio has traditionally been at about 40%. From 1980 until about 2000, no matter the success of the emerging world, the ratio of all 200 emerging nations to the seven richest economies fluctuated at about one-third. Yes, there was a huge success of the emerging nations, but the rich nations also grew and grew rapidly, so that the ratio between them remained stuck at about a third. But something very dramatic happened in 2000. In the 17, 18, 19 years since the year 2000, this ratio has gone haywire. The emerging nations now taken together stand toe to toe at par with the traditional centers of power in terms of combined GDP. Now, let me very quickly say, there are those who will look at this picture and say, wait, this is an unfair comparison. Because obviously there are 200 or so of these emerging nations, and then there are only 7 developed countries. And that's absolutely right. But nobody said I was trying to make a fair comparison. What I'm trying to do is to describe how over time the power relations between them has profoundly changed. And there's no question that it has. A second piece of evidence here is something that had been worked out here at the LSE some time back, showing how the world's economic center of gravity is moving not just to the emerging nations as an abstract notion, but is moving east. So this is a map, a dynamic map of the world's economic center of gravity. World's economic center of gravity is a phrasing that runs off people's tongue. Some years back, I decided to take that metaphor and make it literal. I calculated literally the world's economic center of gravity, and I showed how that steadily shifted east. So again, there is a move away from the traditional centers of power. If we think about the traditional centers of power as being Washington, D.C. or London, then the world's economic center has now diverged from the world's traditional political center. Demand has moved away from where supply continues to be. And then finally, yes, a little bit of play on moral justice. Where are the problems that the world, the global community, needs to solve? Okay. Where is there the tightest group of humanity, ignoring national boundaries, that face a commonality of problems that global policy needs to address? Well, it turns out if you ask where's the world's tightest concentration of 50% of humanity, okay, be very careful. I'm not asking where the world's densest concentration of population is. The answer to that is probably Madison Square Garden or Times Square on a Saturday night. Okay. It's not about density. It's about where the world's 50% of the population lives, sharing a commonality of problems. And the world's small. You can construct that 50%, as Ian Bremmer and others have done, by picking up the United States, Brazil, and Western Europe and saying that's where the world's democratic majority is. But you can also ask the question, where are they most tightly pressed together? And remember, the notion of democracy does not say that you exclude people who are of a different color skin. You don't exclude them because their political religious beliefs are different from yours. You don't exclude them because they don't live in democracies. They are also part of humanity. Well, the world's tightest circle is that one. It's a circle 3,300 kilometers in radius, centered in Shan State, eastern Myanmar. It covers China and India, parts of Indonesia, parts of Japan. And if the world were really a democracy, and democracy were determined by a simple 50% majority vote, it is there that the world would be making decisions of global significance. Okay. So there are 3 large shocks on the demand side, at the same time that the supply side is shifting away from its traditional, that the supply side has its acceptability, has its legitimacy being pulled away. Now, let me not take up any more time, but say that, let me summarize what I've done. I've told you about how international relations scholarship has a wonderful intellectual history on thinking about world order. It is confined to thinking about great power competition and geostrategic rivalry. Mm-hmm. It's about the great powers of the world. And as Kenneth Waltz says, there is an understanding of the world where that makes sense. Because why would you want to spend time talking about smaller nations? They cannot do anything. It is the military hardware in the United States, in Russia, the former Soviet Union, the Cold War that Mick and Arnie studied and have tried to educate me on, China, where world order is determined. But then I said, if you're actually hard-nosed and serious, and you want to think about the system-wide properties, you can't leave with just the thinking about the supply side. Mm. You've got to think about the demand side. And so this brings into play the notion that there's a possible marketplace for world order. Because there's a supply and there's a demand. And what my research is doing is about tracing through the shocks, the disturbances to the supply side and the demand side. And those of you who are economists in the audience, you'll know identification in econometrics is about working out where the shocks are on the supply side and the demand side to figure out where the system is going. And that's all I'm doing. I'm doing qualitative econometrics on the demand side and the supply side to try and understand world order. Part of that also is a discussion about small states and whether they actually have an impact. So in contrast to what Kenneth Waltz asserted, there's actually historical examples of how smaller nations, whether they're Nicaragua, Singapore, the original Dalian League, Saudi Arabia, Cuba, have been able to effect things in the international system around them in a way that would be counted among the Malaysias and Costa Ricas of the world. So let me conclude. In this reframing of world order to think about a marketplace, you can reinterpret hegemonic stability theory as being about the efficiency or otherwise of monopoly. You can understand the stability properties of a hegemon-centered world by trying to identify where the shocks are to the system. You can understand globalization and deglobalization by figuring out who's on the supply side and demand side of the need for an international order. Okay. And at the end of all this, there are two key conclusions. You get a full range of outcomes from a realist assumption. I'm perfectly comfortable talking to the Mearsheimers and Waltz of the world because I enter that discussion making the same assumptions that they do, that nations are self-seeking. Only my nations operate in a marketplace, not just in an oligopolistic situation. You can get outcomes that are efficient and peaceful at the same time that you could potentially get outcomes that are violent and that involve international conflict, but that violence in international conflict is no longer inevitable. There's no longer a tragedy of great power competition. At the same time, this also raises other complications. What do you do about externalities and public goods? And all of that can be discussed. So let me finish. I've done three things in this presentation. I've reminded all of us how world order is traditionally thought of as geostrategic rivalry. And it still is today. Open up the pages of the New York Times any day of the week, and it's about America-China competition and how world order is changing as a result of that. I feel that as scholars, we need to move the discussion away from that. It is up to us as scholars to engage with that discussion on the same playing field, on the same intellectual domain as they do. Not necessarily in terms of just moral justice warrior positions, but that's fine too. I have no objection to that. But in addition, we can engage with that conversation from an economics perspective. I talked about a marketplace for world order. And yes, it is crazy, but that's okay. We talk about a market for ideas. Nobody objects to that anymore, even though ideas are not priced. You can't walk into a shop and buy an idea. You can't walk into a shop and buy a world order. But it's the same thing. We talk about market for marriage partners. No one objects to that idea. It is simply a marketplace. All of these are simply marketplaces. And I've told you about the research that I'm doing on identifying supply and demand. And part of that is about small states' agency in the world. And I've described to you how this perspective recasts our thinking in that you can achieve liberal internationalist outcomes from the modeling, even from realist assumptions. And there are further interesting work to do. So thank you all very much.
Danny, thank you very much for giving a brilliant lecture without mentioning the word Brexit once. For those of us who are completely fed up with the whole debate. But Danny, thank you very much for generating a bunch of ideas, reflections, and I almost take some pride in your lecture myself because I've taught you some IR. And this has been great. So, and you also taught me a lot about political economy, particularly the political economy of Asia and the political economy of China. If I might just abuse the position of the chair very briefly. Firstly, on small powers, if I can say a little bit about that. I'm kind of British, but Irish, with grandparents from Ireland. I lived in Ireland for over 20 years. I also lived in Wales for 7 years in the wonderful town of Aberystwyth. And I kind of got very soft on the reasons of small powers, particularly in this rather peculiarly centralised state in which we happen to live, called the United Kingdom, which may not be with us in a few months' time. So, although I might sound and look like a Brit, you know, I'm not really one myself. But I'm very interested in this whole question of the role of small powers in international relations, which you touched on. And I kind of do take the view, as an IR person, you do study the great powers for the obvious reason that they've got most of the capabilities. And that's the reason. It's not a moral question, as Waltz is. Waltz, by the way, is a very nice guy. But, you know, it was never a moral question. It's a question in the end. You know, if there's an elephant in the room and it sits on a mouse, the mouse is dead and the elephant lives. But if one actually looks basically around what has shaped, determined, influenced world politics, the completely important role of small powers, you know, in the determination of the last 100 years is just absolutely dramatically obvious. I mean, without going into too much listing of details, I mean, you know, the British in 1914 went to war because of Belgium. Not to be forgotten, not just because of Germany, but went, you know, as a kind of principal defence, actually, in a way, of the neutrality and self-determination of a small nation. In 1939, Britain and France went to war against Nazi Germany because of the defence of Poland. So it is a way in which, you know, small powers play a very, very big role in the determination of what great powers then do. And it's not always necessarily malignant either. And I don't think you were saying that, but I just want to raise that point. As an old leftist myself of many, many years standing, I'm still trying to do my best, although most of my children think I've become very bourgeois, I remember standing outside the American embassy shouting, "Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh," and "Down with American imperialism." And that was about Vietnam, which I'm told is not such a small country. After all, there's 100 million people who live there. But nonetheless, you know, this was a small power being trounced upon by a very big one. It was, after all, Afghanistan, which again is a wonderful civilization, but still a small country, which dragged first the Soviet Union in and then the Americans in, and, you know, with all the consequences that we know today. And let's also figure in the Middle East. A small nation called Israel makes a lot of noise without saying it's either bad or positive. So I think there is, and I think in IR there has been a recognition. I agree with you. You know, the bias is always towards the big guys. You know, the A-list, if you wish. But nonetheless, I think the role of small states and powers within the international relations has not been entirely ignored. On the demand side, just quickly on that one, Daniel, because I think that's a great way of thinking about it. I think one of the strengths of the United States may not be just about capabilities and power. It is that a lot of countries in the world have demanded it. Whether one likes it or not, yeah. I remember my old great Norwegian friend, Geir Lundestad, who came from Norway, a small state, by the way, and he wrote a fantastic article 90 some years back on the American Empire by demand, which is about Western Europe. Yeah. And basically he was trying to say, you know, these kind of countries in Western Europe after World War II actually didn't, it wasn't they, Americans, go home in 1946, 47. I don't think so. They said, please come, more of you, more money, more tanks, you know, more Americans. And it was a kind of an empire by demand. No, I'm not going to say that's true of all of what America did in the post-war period. Yeah. And I find that's a kind of an important part of what the strength of America has been. There's been a demand for what it has supplied, if I can put it like that. Whether it's the supply of security, the supply of aid, and by the way, the supply of, at most, at some times, not all, you know, some decent values and some decent stuff and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Ignore the coffee. So there is, and I think what is so interesting about Trump, actually, you know, apart from many, many other things, is he's refusing to provide, he's refusing to supply it. That's what's so interesting about Trump. You know, there may be still countries in the world that demand an American, as you know, in Asia, East Asia, there's quite a dollar demand still for some American presence, let's be perfectly honest about it, related obviously to China to some degree. But what is so weird and strange about Trump is he refuses to supply what a lot of countries in your own region and around the world. So firstly on small powers, then on supply and demand, and looking at the United States. And then we'll open up for Q&A. Danny, over to you.
Thank you, Mick. If I might respond a bit. First, do not take what I say about IR scholars in kind of a personal way. None of this says that anyone is pleasant or unpleasant.
I'm really pleasant.
Yes, he is. One of the things about being a technical economist to begin is that you realize some of the most extreme right-wing free market ideologies are written by people who are extremely nice. They're the kind of avuncular people, grandfatherly in many cases, when I was much younger, who were, you know, just nice people. And something that helped me understand a lot what Mearsheimer and Walt and others were saying is to not think about what they're saying as being. They're not warmongering hawks.
Quite the opposite.
Quite the opposite. They're extremely nice individuals. They're doing what they consider axiomatic science. Okay. The same way that economists do what they consider axiomatic science. And there's nothing personal. Second thing I might say on great powers. You're absolutely right. The IR literature has lots of roles for great powers. But one of the things that's enveloped Singapore over the last 12 months is exactly a discussion among the foreign policy scholars and practitioners about the role of small states in the world. Sure. And there's constant reference to Thucydides. Not just Thucydides of the Thucydides trap, but Thucydides who also said the way the world is, strong states do what they will,
and the weak.
Weak states suffer what they must. The world is run by strong states. And, of course, what you and I are saying, nice liberal people that we are...
Hey, who are you calling a liberal? I mean, come on.
Is that, you know, there's lots of role for small states. Yeah, Thucydides was wrong. And it's wrong not just probably about the trap, but also wrong in his reading of what small states, big states... are capable of doing. Yeah. This gets me to your remark about capability, that it's fine for us to look at the large states because they're the ones with their capability. The taxi companies used to be the one with the taxis. But what makes for a taxi market, what makes for the operation of a taxi marketplace is not just the group of those who have the taxis. But it's the taxis combined with the right services, combined with the innovation and the technology, and ultimately the consumer. So international politics is not just about the capabilities, not just about the aircraft carriers and the military, but it's about also the demand side. And then finally, my last statement in response to what Mick says, Mick inserted a statement about liberal values. And of course, that's always been part of the idea behind liberal internationalism. That at the same time that we the system constructors, system builders in the US and the UK and elsewhere, same time that we opened up the system, we hope to inject into everybody else the same understanding of individual liberties, personal freedoms, human rights, respect for the individual over the state that we ourselves enjoy. And that's been part of a problem, because not all the world operates this way. And a lot of the world is perfectly fine without the notion of unbridled liberty, without the notion that the individual takes primacy over the state, because they view the state as being benevolent, as being avuncular. The state takes care of them. And they're quite happy to hand over individual liberties. It's what works for them. And if nothing else, this new discussion, renewed discussion of the way world order operates ought to bring back is the idea that there are multiple pathways to political and economic success.
Yeah.
I am a great admirer of Western liberal values, but I don't go around saying it is for everyone, because it isn't.
Okay, Danny, I think we've got a debate there. I think there's a gentleman at the back. His hand has gone up very rapidly. I'm going to start at the front and then where are the mic guys? Mics?
Oh,
we only got the one mic?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, the LSE is an austerity already, isn't it? Yeah. You can come to the front first. I think somebody had their hand up here.
Can we
take a few questions. Don't worry. Try and make them just one individual question rather than a whole. Thanks, please. Say who you are as well, please.
Sure. David Brenner, formerly of King's College London. Thank you for your talk. There is as at least on the theoretical side of things, one IR school that does focus on demand, which is realism. Simply on the view that they view the entire world, and very importantly, they view all states to suffer from this view of insecurity, and that this insecurity then informs their desire. I mean, this is essentially what has been discussed already, or in quotes, but this view that it does affect all actors in this international system. Sure. What do you think about that? I mean, given it's, do you view states as the only level of actor, then they're irrelevant, and so on and so forth?
Sure, okay. So one,
I'll take the gentleman at the back because he had his hand up. For you better just shout.
Yes.
Yeah, shout. You've got a loud voice like me. Go for it.
I have one question but two parts.
Oh my gosh. All right, do it anyway.
No, I have a supply and demand question. Demand question first. Can you comment on the fact that we were talking always about, you know, nation states being kind of the, you know, the classic way, and then we have these great power thing. What about, you know, this recent developments of kind of, you know, Parakanas thing, for example, of these kind of, you know, para-sovereign stuff, you know, cities. We had Rahm Emanuel, mayor of Chicago last week at LSE saying, yeah, you know, he's going to cooperate with other cities, you know, because they have more GDP than countries. We have companies like Amazon who have, you know, more turnover than you know, like a G30 state or so, you know, that could be easily in the G20s or so. Mm. So are your theories, or can you comment on this? What does he mean in the world where the nation state is being, you know, Moses Naim end of power, kind of hollowed out from kind of, you know, para-sovereign, you know, city-state type of things, corporate fiefdoms, new feudalistic stuff. And on the supply side, a quick comment probably on how do you see the European Union here in this kind of great game? I mean, you know, it's still the largest, even after this, you know, what's left of the United Kingdom will leave or whatever. You know, it's still the largest economic bloc. Will it ever be a power bloc? Will it be forced by the US retreat to do this, or will it stay a kind of a economic bloc without any power? Or what is the definition of power for the European Union?
And it's the bloc. EU actually defined as a great power, which is kind of interesting. There's a gentleman in the middle. There's two along here. Please, yeah, just put it along there. There's a lady there, a woman there, and then a gentleman. Yeah, hi, who you are, where, doesn't matter, you know, generally.
Hi, I'm Lara Cointon from Shoresman College. Thank you, Professor Kwok, for your lecture. Putting on your economist hat, how do you reconcile, when we talk about great powers, China's interesting self-categorization as a developing economy in this discussion?
Wait, sorry, I couldn't see you.
I couldn't hear that either. So could you say that again?
So sorry.
You could stand up.
No, okay.
I can't see you. Oh, okay, there you are.
Hi, how are you? Thank you.
Ask the question again, just briefly, again.
How do you reconcile China's almost self-categorization as a developing economy when we talk about these great powers?
Right. Okay, very good. Thanks.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Alex from Warwick University and Tsinghua University.
All right.
So I had a question around, I believe that some of these global powers, I don't believe it's a zero-sum game, even though Trump seems to suggest it is. And I just want to ask both of you your views on how Professor Kwok's model, does it incorporate the idea that global economy or the power for the global struggle for power is not a zero-sum game? And if so, how does it do that?
And that gets us back to the dear old Thucydides trap, which has been much talked about in Washington and, by to say, in Beijing. There was somebody in front of you. Yeah, pass it down. We'll take this round first and then we'll come back again as soon as we can. Okay. Yeah, hi. Tell you who we are.
Hi. Yeah, hi, Professor. I'm Wen Jie. I'm from the LSE as well. So my question is very specific to your suggestion for marketplace. What I was actually expecting from the presentation was actually what we can do with this system of marketplace, because I feel like what you have identified is the existence or the potential existence of demand forces and supply forces for world order. But what can we do about it? And what is exactly the price indicator on the y-axis? What is going to bring the system into equilibrium? You know, you mentioned about marriage and ideas, but there are businesses like matchmaking agencies who can make use of that market, the demand and supply, to actually create a business. So what can we do with this marketplace?
Do you run a marriage agency?
I don't, but
you're working on it now, I imagine, yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. Okay, that's what we call the Lenin question, which is what is to be done?
Okay.
Stodgillet, as they used to say. Daniel, a number of questions there.
Yeah,
let me start. To work backwards,
I might not be able to hit every single one, but just to get things going. First, I'd like to put together the do actors remain as nation states with the question about what we can do about it. So here's one implication from this perspective, with pointed to what we do about this. The marketplace endows legitimacy on the supplier. Legitimacy not in the traditional sense of I accept it because, you know, like in the U.S. Constitution, you have consent of the governed. But what it does is it endows legitimacy to those who provide it because it satisfies my need on the demand side. Now, who that supplier is, the demand side really does not care. It does not care if it's an entire nation state or a city or a company. If Facebook gives the 1.6 billion of us who are members of it a sense of citizenship larger than all nations in the world, including China and India, we are Facebook citizens, and it provides us a certain service. And I think that, what this does is it unpacks the notion of global public goods into services and into characteristics and attributes rather than what the whole package implies. So what can we do about this? It says that a traditional way of thinking about, say, the hegemon, the supplier of world order, is that the hegemon both gives military security, an umbrella architecture that keeps all of us safe, at the same time that it helps stabilize financial markets, is the Keynesian consumer of last resort, and all these other things. The marketplace interpretation gets us away from that, and it opens us up to the possibility of organizing international structures so that we can decouple the providers of these different goods and services. So let me phrase it this way. If you want a competent regulator of international financial markets, why does that regulator need an aircraft carrier? You want regulation of international financial markets, come to Singapore. You don't have to go to the United States.
Exploiting us post-Brexit Britain here. I can feel it coming on.
You don't have to look at just the single nation state as the supplier. So decouple the goods and services that world order provides across different players. Cities can be part of that provision. Some will have to be done by entire nations, but they don't all have to be. On the question of whether there is acknowledgement of small states in the literature, that, you know, if you just do through Google Scholar, JSTOR, and you just do small states and international relations scholarship, yes, you find vast troves. And realism in interpreting how individual nation states behave is part of that thinking. I have no objection to that. The question is, what do we think is critical for the formation, the evolution, and the trajectory of the international system? And there are many. There's a lot of scholarship that says what we do is we look at great power competition. Because as Mick says, those are the ones that have the capacity. Small states don't have the capacities. They too are concerned about survival in this realist landscape, but they don't have the capacity. My argument is actually they do have the capacity on the demand side. That's the critical difference. Can I just leave it as that?
China.
Developing how does economy. China figure in this? The line between what America and China can supply, I think, came clearest as Trump was withdrawing from TPP, was arguing for pulling manufacturing back to the United States at the same time that Xi Jinping mounted the stage at Davos World Economic Forum and said, we need an ever more globalized world. We need nations trading with each other. Globalization is like the light that shines in a dark room. The question, those are alternative visions of what they can supply. The question is, what does the world demand? In Asia, what we demand is greater trade. In many advanced economies, they say, yes, we want trade, but let's manage how globalization trade proceeds. Let's take care of the disadvantage in our societies. Let's make sure that there's not emissarization that happens at the same time as trade continues to grow. I think there are alternative sides to demand, just as there are different supply being
on offer now. The European Union is part of that equation. The European Union offers something quite different in management of the international data architecture, in its perception of globalization and trade. So we've got a range of suppliers, and we've got different structures to demand. How that marketplace forms is how we should be approaching this problem.
Could I just pick up on, I think it was Alex, was it, in the middle there, on the question of, is it zero sum? I think that was your... I don't mind taking that one, Danny.
Yeah, could you?
Given that I've just read Thucydides' Peloponnesian War again, and I've just set this exam question for some of my executive master students, and I had to read 32... very good answers on the whole question of the Thucydides trap, which connects to China and the United States. I won't kind of summarise what every essay said, but in broad terms, I think I think it is correct to pose the problem and the danger of a trap. My view is always it's better to think the worst because you might avoid it. If you think the worst can't happen, there's a very good chance it might. I always think about the origins of World War I. In part, why did it happen? Many reasons, but it happened because a lot of people thought it could never happen, because they thought globalization or whatever they call it, trade, would prevent it, which is actually very dangerous. So I'm actually quite in favour of a serious debate like Graham Allison and others, and indeed on the Chinese side by President Xi Jinping and the people who advise him, and actually thinking there is a danger. There is a very real danger, and the realists tell us there's a danger, and that's fair enough, and I'm perfectly happy with that. So I don't think we should run away from this danger because we don't like the idea. I think, however, that there are ways in which this danger can be avoided. A, by recognising it. History does teach us something, not very much, but it sometimes might teach us something. But I think, you know, in essence, I think there are a number of things, and here Danny and I surely would agree. I mean, one, without being, you know, too nuclear, you know, nuclear states don't go to war with each other for a very simple reason, that's death. You know, that's kind of survival. And you've got two nuclear states. Secondly, I do actually buy into the theory of globalization in the 21st century. Supply chains, everything else. Sorry, this is mutually assured economic destruction. And you could actually see this with Trump. You know, he's desperately keen to have a trade war with China, kind of make China change, regime change almost, isn't it? Economic regime change. But he knows damn well that if he pushes that hard, A, China will retaliate, and B, the markets back in the United States are going to make sure he's not president in 2020. Because he depends on that. And thirdly, of course, the knock-on effects to the world economy are just dramatic. In other words, and also institutions play a role. Let's not forget the UN. Let's not forget the number of international conferences which are taking place. Let's not forget student participation, students going to the United States from China, American students, you know, European students, sorts of things. All this adds up to creating something like what I would call, broadly speaking, an international society. Mm-hmm. It's much more of a society now than it was in 1914. And I think all of that is, you know, plus people do learn the lessons of history. You know, they don't want to go another war. And I think, therefore, we need to recognise the dangers, talk about them openly, you know, read Graham Allison's book. He sold enough copies already, so don't go and buy it. You get it. You know, but I think that's very important. Yeah. I know what you feel about that.
Yeah. But the zero-sum point that is a hugely important one. I didn't mean to ignore it. Let me say, add a little bit to what Mick said.
Yeah.
The quintessential zero-sum game is a ranking. Who's number one? Who's number two? As long as the world, the international system, as long as geopolitics continues to think about who's number one, who's number two, we have locked ourselves into a zero-sum game.
Yeah.
Because number two can only become number one if number one loses its position.
That's right.
One nation advances only when another loses. Yeah. One of the benefits of moving to a marketplace-type interpretation of this is we come away, get away from this idea of thinking that it's just number one, number two. If America used to be the supplier of world order and now is potentially going to lose that position, America can do a number of things. It can work harder. It can be innovative. It can try to come up with other ways in which it can appeal to the demand side. It can once again attract legitimacy in the world markets. Okay. Mm. One thing that I left out of this is, although I constructed this theoretical idea, I talked about the forces, identify shocks, I did not say what's going to happen to U.S.-China competition.
Uh-huh.
I did not say, will America remain the number one power, the center of this architecture. And for the simple reason is, I think we don't know. There's nothing in the reasoning that says one way or the other. But what we do know is that if America does not get its act together, continues to run itself down in the eyes of legitimacy of the rest of the world, loses its position as the supply side provider to some other provider, whether that provider is China or somebody else, we will see a very different world order emerge.
My colleague, very quickly, Barry Buzan, who works on these issues a lot, actually thinks there is no superpower world coming. You know, the idea that there's one and that something's going to replace it, he kind of does believe in the broad terms of American long-term relative decline. And Trump is kind of, you know, paying into that rather famously, isn't he? You know, he's paid to help America decline almost, it seems. But China isn't going to become the number one, nor does China want to become. So you may move into what we might call now a kind of no superpower kind of world. Anyway, we take two or three more to go, can we?
We're out of time.
No, we're not. We're taking one or two more questions. I'm boss. Won't be two minutes and then you can go home. Okay. Can we just take one? Are we?
Yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Sorry, everybody. Say thank you to Danny Kwa. I've been told people. Sorry, guys.